It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
The Republicans' worst nightmare had come to pass. Theodore Roosevelt was no longer just a heartbeat from the presidency. He was the president. T.R., as he liked to be called, was a complicated man, a mass of contradictions, and he could not be bullied. He was a conservative, yet he fought for reform. He was a hunter who started the conservation movement, a hawk on war who won the Nobel Peace Prize. Perhaps the only thing that can be easily understood about him is that he was an original.
T.R. never identified himself as a Republican. In fact, I've read a letter recently that's been unpublished that his uncle wrote and said what they don't understand about Teddy is that he's a Democrat, that he was both. He never thought in terms of pure party politics. He thought about what was right for the American people. And that's a great lesson for presidents to learn. You don't represent your party as much as you represent the people. If you do what's right for the most people, what you think's right, you're going to be a great president.
All right, that's from the History Channel, and that's the story of Teddy Roosevelt, who was the 26th president of the United States. Now, why am I talking about him? Because once I finish this conversation about this brand new book on Teddy Roosevelt, you'll understand it. The book is called Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. Some of you know, I was, you know, racking my own brain thinking, what do I know about Teddy Roosevelt? Well, he was part of the Rough Riders who did whatever it was that they did. I think it was the Spanish-American War, I think. And then I thought, well, he's the one who said, walk softly and carry a big stick. And that's true. He did say that. He was a great president, they say. There's an entire island dedicated to him in Washington, D.C., it's the Theodore Roosevelt Island. It has all this granite, these monuments to him in which he has written his words of wisdom about manhood and youth and nature and the nation. So I know those things. And then I've heard a lot of great quotes. I'll read one of them to you. This might ring a bell. It is not the critic who counts. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by the dust and sweat and the blood, who strives valiantly, who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory or defeat. That's Teddy Roosevelt. But who was this man? Why is he considered one of the greatest presidents? Why is it we don't know about him? William Hazelgrove joins me today. It's his new book we're going to talk about. William is the author of Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson, which, by the way, has won lots of awards, History Book Club selection. He's written 10 novels. He was the Ernest Hemingway writer in residence. He's been interviewed on all kinds of places, but I want to get right to talking to William Hazelgrove this morning. Good morning, William.
Good morning.
Hey, look, I'm curious, before we start into Teddy Roosevelt here, how does one start writing about history? I mean, I love history, but how did you gravitate toward this kind of topic?
You know, as you said, I had written a lot of novels. I had a master's in history, and really I started with Madam President, The Secret Presidency of Edith Wilson. I was reading Scott Berg's biography, and he had a really interesting line where he said, well, she was almost the president, referring to when Wilson had this massive stroke in 1919. And I thought, well, that's very different. So then upon investigation, I realized she did become president for 2 years. And so she was really our first woman president. So then I went down the road of, well, if I can recreate this in a way that people want to read, and Eric Larson does this very well in Devil in the White City, where you novelize actually history and make it into a story that people will want to read, then, you know, this is really something very interesting to combine the two. So that's really how I started you know, writing narrative, what they call now is narrative nonfiction, which is the kind of history we like to read, you know, Candace Millard's book, River of Doubt, other books like that, that people just love because, you know, history is enjoying this incredible renaissance right now. All you have to do is turn on the television and look at all the historical series that are on.
You know, I do know that. The thing, the caution for me always is that you can't trust every person who's writing history, and most people who even know much of our history are not necessarily getting it from the best sources because it's easy to twist it. It's easy to change facts to bring a perspective that is not centric to that particular time and space. And so what's your own philosophy about that? When you write about someone like Teddy Roosevelt who died, what, in 1888 or something, how do you keep perspective and what is your commitment to truth about this story?
Well, you know, one thing I always want to do is I always want to cite all my sources. There's like 500 footnotes, I think, in Forging a President, the new book. And I always try and go to primary sources. For secondary sources are all those books that everybody's already written. So you start there, you read all that. Then you dive deeper and you go try and find the papers, you know, the actual sources that, you know, will tell you the real story. And again, I'm a thesis-driven historian, so what I'm doing is, like, with the new book, my thesis is the West created Teddy Roosevelt, that there is Teddy Roosevelt before the West, and then he went into the West. That gave us the man who became president, the barrel-chested Teddy Roosevelt.
You're my kind of guy, then. You're my kind of historian, then, because I really... Look, the truth is just fascinating enough. We don't need help, you know, with that, so...
I
need to correct myself. He was born in 1858. He died in 1919, just to put him in the space of time. So born right before the Civil War, died, you know, during, I guess, the World War One, or somewhere around there, right after
World War I. Exactly right. Actually, toward the tail of World War One, just ended, exactly.
Okay, so William, we have to start with the thing that he's known for is all of his boldness, his outdoors, his cowboy past, his Rough Riders. But before he got to that, he had a very, very difficult childhood. Tell us at least a bit about that.
Well, this is what's fascinating. This is what people just don't know. Teddy Roosevelt was an incredibly sickly child. He had acute asthma, the kind of asthma that just killed people. And this is at a time when there was absolutely no therapies for it. You know, the best comparison is suffocation. His parents were wealthy. So they would take him all over to spas to try and actually just get a sea breeze or something like that so their son could breathe. And a great image is this. His father, they lived in Manhattan, would put him into the carriage, a black carriage at night, and with the horses, and he would ride really quickly through the streets of Manhattan and have his son, Teddy Roosevelt, hang his head out the side with his mouth open to force air down into his lungs so he could breathe. And this is how, you know, desperate they were. They'd give him coffee, cigars, anything that they could get to try and break these spasmodic attacks of asthma. So he's very sickly. He has chronic digestive problems. He's way underweight. Doctors don't even think he's going to make it to become an adult. He is, you know, and he's almost anorexic. He's that skinny. He has insomnia. He is not a well person. And so, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is this very vigorous man. Well, the question is, what happened to him? How did he become this you know, the titan that we know now through history from this sickly asthmatic?
Yeah. Well, before you go into that, because that's the thrust of your book, what happened to change that? I just couldn't help. Actually, William, I'll make this personal for a second. I had a very sick child that I took care of for the 20 years of my life. And I just related to, no matter, the Roosevelts were very wealthy people. He was related to Franklin, Delano, and Eleanor, right? They were cousins.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this is a very wealthy, I never thought about it, but they were Dutch. Dutch magnates, and of course, they had all the money in the world, but all the money in the world could not buy health for their son. And I think the part of this story is that he actually had to learn to fight his own illness, sort of fight the fact that he couldn't breathe, and live through that all repeatedly, where he thought he was going to die, where he couldn't breathe.
That's right. And that's a great point to bring up, because if your biggest struggle in life is just to stay alive. Everything else is going to be easier. Mm-hmm. So at a very early age, he had this incredible struggle just to breathe. So I think this gives a real insight into, you know, what we'll talk about later, hardships he endured did not compare to the hardships he endured as a child. So he became incredibly tough.
Yeah, I mean, and so that's just amazing to me. I want to read one of his quotes. I don't know if this, if you've got, I'm sure you have a lot of quotes in your book. This is from a different source. It just says, "A soft, easy life is not worth living. If it impairs the fiber of brain and heart and muscle, we must dare to be great, and we must realize that greatness is the fruit of toil and sacrifice and high courage. For us is the life of action, of strenuous performance of duty. Let us live in the harness, striving mightily. Let us rather run the risk of wearing out than rusting out." All right, so, but that's not the end of his sorrow, the illness as a child. You talk about a night that changed his life, really. And tell us about that, William.
Yes. Well, he'd become a young assemblyman in Albany. So, you know, this is 1883. His life is going great. He's married this beautiful little socialite, Alice Lee. They have a house in Manhattan. She's pregnant, or she's having her, in fact, she's having their baby. Everything's going great for Teddy Roosevelt. His political career is starting. He gets a telegram saying, "Come home immediately. You know, mother is sick." And he gets another telegram saying, "Alice Lee is very sick." So he takes the train back. It's a very foggy night in Manhattan, strangely foggy. He runs through this fog. You can't even see your hand in front of your face. Gets to the Roosevelt Mansion, and there his wife is dying from Bright's disease, which is a kidney disease complicated by having this baby. And his mother is dying from typhoid fever. So on the same day, his mother dies and his wife dies. Teddy Roosevelt, who kept the diary, put a big X on that day and said the light had gone out of his life. And this is certainly true. This is the absolute low point, as it would be for anybody. But, I mean, he's so devastated, he doesn't even register that he has a baby daughter. It doesn't even hit his radar. He is just, you know, people were fearful for his sanity. They thought he couldn't function anymore. He is devastated.
William, at this point in his life, what was his own health like?
Well, he's you know, still a very, very slight young man. He's still severely asthmatic. And he had these severe, we would probably call it Crohn's disease today, where just severe diarrhea. He would get literally bedridden for days from this. And you know, this would keep his weight down. He couldn't trust his own body. And he had a very squeaky little speaking voice. That actually, when he went to Albany, a lot of the other, you know, legislators laughed at him. I mean, he was this very little guy. And so, you know, this devastation comes on top of his own physical, frail condition, and it sort of knocks him down more.
Well, I guess it's probably fair to say, too, that until the recent past, actually, men in America counted their manhood by their outdoors ability, by their strength, by their sheer prowess. And of course, he could not even hardly survive, let alone compete in that arena. When we come back, William Hazelgrove will tell us more about how the Wild West created Teddy Roosevelt, because what happened was he got on a train and headed west, and it is just the beginning of the story. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Roosevelt, more than anybody, believed America needed a canal through the Central American Isthmus owned by Colombia.
The thought was this canal was going to be a way to protect both seas of America, that any moment if the East Coast was attacked, the West Coast fleet could quickly come to its aid.
Now, Roosevelt believed this canal, the Panama Canal, would be a very good thing for the United States, but he believed it would also be a very good thing for the world.
The Colombian government didn't exactly agree with Roosevelt, at least not at the price he was offering. So, once again, Roosevelt took unorthodox measures. He backed a local revolution and helped create the nation of Panama in exchange for the right to build a canal there.
He was criticized very heavily for his high-handed role in dealing with the government of an independent American republic, for basically giving them the back of his hand, and for fomenting revolution. But he never apologized.
He used to say, I didn't steal the Panama Canal, I built it.
It was the largest engineering project ever undertaken. And when it was completed, it became one of the wonders of the world.
When it opened, Roosevelt believed that that was his major contribution to world civilization. And he never changed his mind about that.
All right, that's just to give you an idea. That's from the History Channel, and that's just a little excerpt. That is one, just one of the things that President Theodore Roosevelt did when he was serving the country. Just to give you some background, he served in his early life as a New York assemblyman, a New York City police commissioner, a lieutenant colonel in the Spanish-American War, an assistant secretary of the Navy, the governor of New York, and then the vice president to William McKinley. And William McKinley, of course, was assassinated in 1901, and Teddy Roosevelt became the country's youngest president at age 43. That was Teddy Roosevelt, and that's who we're talking about today. This is Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk. The new book is called Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. And my guest is William Hazelgrove, who wrote this book, and it's just fresh off the press. It's published by Regnery, and I have to tell you, I'm enjoying this tremendously. I knew something about Teddy Roosevelt, but I had no idea. So, William, when we last spoke, Teddy Roosevelt had lost both his mother and his wife within a 24 period in the same house, and had a baby daughter that survived during the childbirth, but not the mother, not his lovely wife that he loved. And he was just in shock. So pick it up. What does he do and where does he go?
Okay, at this point, he does something very interesting. It's 1883. There still is a Wild West, but it'll all be over by 1890, though. The frontier will be declared closed. Teddy Roosevelt goes back to Albany, throws himself into his work, but basically his political career disintegrates. And then he does a very strange thing. He goes to the Dakota Territory, which is the Wild West of the time. This is the Badlands, which is just this incredibly hostile area. He takes a train out there. He gets dropped off in a town called Little Missouri, which is rated one of the worst towns by the railroad in terms of shootings and everything else. It's a Wild West town. And he literally steps off the train, this dude from New York, 26 years old. He has all these new cowboy clothes that he bought at Brooks Brothers and stuff. He gets off, and he's in the middle of the night. You can hear the Little Missouri River, and he's in this Wild West town, and he goes and to meet this guy named Joe Ferris, who will take him, basically be sort of his guide into the West. And the first thing he wants to do is go hunt buffalo. Okay, now Teddy Roosevelt believes one thing, and that is action. Action trumps everything. Yeah, he has a great quote where he says, you know, black care rarely bothers the rider who rides fast enough. And basically what he's saying is, if you stay busy, if you go on, then this awful, awful depression, this awful grief will not affect you. And it won't affect him. And so, but basically what he's doing is he's going west to remake himself, to find himself. And, you know, and this is what the frontier did for America. You know, this is hard for us to understand, but this is at a time when you could leave the East, let's say your life disintegrated, and then you could go to the West and recreate yourself. You could become somebody else, and because it was wide open. You know, we bought all this territory from the French Louisiana Purchase. We just We didn't have anybody to run it. We didn't have any law out there. We didn't have any churches. It was wild. So the government wanted people to go out there and settle it, and the people used it as sort of a national purge valve, or, you know, sort of an escape valve where, you know, life didn't work out for me. I'm going to go remake myself. And that's what Teddy Roosevelt does. He goes west to remake himself.
Now, he's still this weak guy. He's still the asthma, I guess, is still haunting him. I don't know what degree, but he's still weak. He's just lost his mother and his wife. And do you think that he had any idea really what he was doing? I mean, he did remake himself, but do you think he had a plan?
I don't think he had a specific plan. I think he went out there to mourn, to recreate himself. And, you know, the first thing he does is his asthma does improve immediately because the air is very dry, okay? And this is very good for him. And this vigorous life takes hold where he becomes this cowboy. You know, he has a ranch. He'd been out there once before, and it's hard for us to believe, but it was sort of in vogue then to buy a ranch. And Roosevelt had the kind of money where he could buy a ranch. And so he went out there, and he immediately starts this cowboy life, and this starts to invigorate him and build him up. First thing he does is, again, they try and find this buffalo, and they can't find one because mostly the buffalo have been just almost exterminated by then now because of the government and the Indians and everybody who's just been wiping them out, the Winchester repeating rifle. Well, Roosevelt is out in the middle of the night. You know, this just gives me an idea of how, you know, the myth of the West starts sort of colliding with reality. Roosevelt is out in the middle of the night. They're out in the middle of the Badlands. They've lost. They basically had to camp there. Their horses have run away from them because they were asleep, and the horses took off. And it starts to rain. And the guy, Joe Ferris, is with Roosevelt, and he thinks Roosevelt's this dude, this skinny little guy from the East, and he's got these big, thick glasses, so nobody respects him. They think he's just another one of these weird guys who came out for a little bit of cowboy fun. And they're laying there on the ground, and it's raining, and Roosevelt says, "By God, this is fun. You know, by God, for you, I'm having a great time." And, you know, and Joe Ferris just can't believe that this guy would say something like that because they've already gone through hell, you know, trying to find this buffalo. They've been out for days and days and days. But again, Roosevelt's got incredible grit. It can take incredible abuse, and this is the beginning. You know, when I started to research this, I realized that destiny is something very real because, as we talk further, we'll go through this, but I realized that anybody else would be dead from what happened to Roosevelt out west. But Roosevelt never is hurt. He survives, and he survives to become president.
You know, as you say this, William, of course, what goes through my mind is what we just talked about. When you are struggling for breath, not just once, but time after time after time after time, you're fighting for your life. That's the pattern of your young life. Honestly, it really does kind of make sense that nothing really daunted him because he had already fought. You know, that I can only imagine what it's like to die. You know, not be able to breathe. Not many of us have that experience. But that just explains his grit so much. Now, how did you research this? Did he do a diary? Did Joe do a diary? How did you find out what they did?
Well, you know, he left extensive writings on the West. Roosevelt was our most prolific president. And he wrote, you know, very quickly after being out there, he started writing about it, you know, about being out west, what it's like to hunt out west, what it's like to ranch out west. It's probably 6 or 7 books he wrote. And so this is primary sources. You know, this is his reflections. And Roosevelt was a very good writer. He was a very poetic writer. And, you know, when you read, a lot of times in the book, I use his writing because he's so good at it. And so this gave me the flavor of it. And then, of course, I would check other sources against it. Herman Hagedorn's book, written shortly after Roosevelt died, Roosevelt in the Badlands, is a great resource because he was able to talk to people who were still alive and knew Roosevelt out west.
Well, I just think reading his quotes, I printed out a bunch of his quotes today just because I wanted to read them. And even that's just like, I think I could do a whole show with his quotes. Like he says here, a soft, easy life, I think I read this one, is not worth living. If it impairs the fiber, I did, of brain and heart and muscle, we must dare to be great, and we must realize that greatness is the fruit of toil and sacrifice and high courage. For us is the life of action, of strenuous performance of duty. Let us live in the harness, striving mightily. Let us rather run the risk of wearing out than rusting out. All right, so I'm just curious about something. You know, when I grew up, Wild West shows and John Wayne, and, you know, we were really fascinated with the West. The movies were about the West. And I wonder how much of that came from the writings of Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, you know, that's a great, great question, because during the time Roosevelt's out, and this is where history gets very interesting, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show is going on out east. The West started being marketed very early by the East Coast presses, okay? So Buffalo Bill realized that people in the East wanted to know about cowboys, and Roosevelt went to this show, okay? And in Buffalo Bill show, the cowboys would come in and rescue the settlers in their little cabin from the Indians. He even took the Battle of Little Bighorn and allowed Custer to be rescued by him. And you see, at this time, too, in our history, people are beginning to work in offices, factories, and there's a guy named Beard, Dr. Beard, who came up with this theory where he said people becoming weak and punny and were dying of diseases like cancer and heart disease. He called it neurasthenia. He said it was all this labor of the mind over the body. Well, what's Roosevelt's philosophy? He says the vigorous life is the life. And people want this. They want to know that, you know, their past life, the frontier that's vanishing, is still there for them. So Buffalo Bill supplies that. He says, yes, we're still vigorous. Yes, we can, you know, prosper as a physical people and not just these punny little people working in offices. So the East loves this stuff. They love Roosevelt's writings about the West. They love Buffalo Bill's show. And yes, it all contributes to the big mythology that eventually will become a movie industry for us, where, you know, Westerns will rule till about 1970 in terms of cinema. You know, so this myth of the West, this big mythology of the West, you know, goes on today.
When you use the word myth, you're not talking about untruth, though, are you? You're talking about...
No.
You don't mean it that way.
The mythology of it, which is, yeah, is how it came down through history, the Wild West. No, there is reality to it because, again, in the book, Roosevelt went and lived it.
You talked earlier about when he got on the train, he headed for the Badlands, the Dakota Territory. Well, of course, to the modern listener who has hardly heard of Teddy Roosevelt, they don't know what that is, and I can't explain it either. And I'd love to have you tell us what the Dakota Territory was known for and why it was called the Badlands.
Well, the Badlands is a very interesting area. It's this sort of geologic, amazing place. There's actually lignite fires burning. Okay, imagine this. I think of this rocky terrain that's all red, hardened red clay, carved out over millions of years, sort of a mini Grand Canyon. And in it, there's literally, from the interior of the earth, are burning coal fires dotting the landscape. So when Roosevelt first goes out there and heads west, okay, now he went off on a five-day solitary journey right away, just him and his horse, he went out west. He's going across this barren, brutal landscape. It looks like something from the moon. And sees these fires actually burning in the earth. And these are called lignite fires, and they burn all the time. You know, they're sulfury. It has sort of a smell. And so you would have these buttes, which were these rock formations that looked like created by aliens and went straight up to the sky. We'll see these in Westerns at times, you know, when they do these big panoramic shots of just think of a sort of rock monument shooting up. The Badlands gets incredibly hot. Goes up to 116 degrees in the summer and goes down to negative 40 in the winter. Many, many men freeze to death in the Badlands. Many men, die in the summer in the heat. You know, just prostrate from the heat. So it's incredibly forbidden. Now, also, there's Indians in the Badlands still. Okay, so, and Roosevelt, very early on, goes out looking for some horses, way out into the Badlands. And he's by himself, of course, he does this a lot. And he comes upon five Indians, and they charge him, like, just charge him right at him. And you know, and there have been bad, bad Indian wars. You know, Geronimo's still out there running around. You know, to give you a historical fix, Billy the Kid was just killed a few years before. The James brothers were killed maybe 3 years before. Indian wars are still breaking out here and there. So this is not a good situation.
William, I'm going to interrupt you. We're going to take a commercial break. We're going to come back. Okay, this is the tease. So what happened with Teddy Roosevelt and those five Indians all by himself out in the Badlands? And other stories. The book is called Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. And we'll be right back with William Hazelgrove in just a second. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
By the end of his term, Roosevelt had preserved more than 230 million acres of land. But it's only one part of his legacy. He also created better labor conditions, business regulations, and strengthened America's position on the world stage.
I think Teddy Roosevelt was a good president, and the main reason I say that is foreign policy. He had a vision, he had plans, and he made them happen.
Theodore Roosevelt was the first president to realize what an important moral position the president had simply by being president. A president represents the American people. The president can articulate the views of the American people, but he can also influence those views and to mobilize the American people behind important reforms.
Theodore Roosevelt's legacy is with us every time you turn on a faucet and take a sip of water that's not contaminated. It's with you every time you cook a hamburger on a grill and know you're not going to die from it. It's with you every time you want to take a hike through the Sierra Nevada mountains or go for a swim in the Great Lakes.
Roosevelt agonized over leaving the presidency. There was so much more he wanted to do. But true to his word to the American people, he did not run for re-election in 1908. It was a decision that would haunt him for the rest of his life.
All right, that's again History Channel, the life of Teddy Roosevelt, the 26th President of the United States. William Hazelgrove is my guest, and his new book is called Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. And we're just in the middle of a story, and if you like cowboys and Indians, the real ones, you have to hear this story. So Teddy Roosevelt lost his mother and his wife in 24 hours. Tragic. He's from a wealthy family. Reeling from the loss of them, and yet from a wealthy family could have had anything, and having been forged as a severe asthmatic as a child, just fighting for his life, he decided to get on a train, go to the Badlands, which was the wild, wild, dangerous West. And it not only was dangerous geographically, it was dangerous because it had Indians. And so, William, let's pick up on that story again and talk about what happened when Roosevelt went off by himself and met up with five Indians.
Okay, right. So he's out there by himself. The Indians charge him. Right. So he's on his horse by himself with his Winchester. He sees the Indians. Indians come galloping toward him, about four Indians. Now, there's stories going all around of these terrible mutilations that have occurred, Indians have done to people. In fact, people carry poison with them. A lot of cowboys have poison because they don't want to be tortured. All right. So Roosevelt swings down off his horse, Manitou, that was his horse, and takes out his Winchester, puts it across the horse's back, across the pommel or across the saddle, and pins it right to the center Indian. And he stands there, and he says later, you know, I figured I was going to probably get killed, but men will think twice, Indians will think twice, if they know a few of them will go with me. So he's just waiting. They charge him. Suddenly, they come to a stop, and they stare at him, and they sort of, you know, evaluate him. And then one of them actually speaks English and says, you know, we're friends. And Roosevelt says, no, don't come any closer. And he sees the other ones trying to sort of sneak around him. And again, he swings the rifle over both ways. They sort of stop, and they sort of try and say they're friends again. And he says, that's fine, but stay where you are. And so then the Indians, as Roosevelt says, he found out they had quite a knowledge of English as they cursed at him. And then Roosevelt gets back on his horse and turns, and they follow him a long way, and then eventually sort of they fade away. But here's what's interesting. Roosevelt's encounter with the Indians at this point is exactly what's occurring in a Wild West show out east. So, again, you have the real thing going on, and then you have a sort of show of something that's going to vanish very quickly. So Roosevelt's right. He has a foot in both worlds at this point.
You know, I was just saying, here's another quote I found from him. We already know he said, when he became president, he said, walk softly but carry a big stick. Okay, so he's known for that. But this is an earlier quote. He says, the unforgivable crime is soft hitting. Do not hit at all if it can be avoided, but never hit softly. I just love that. Right. But anyway, so I one of my favorite stories that you tell is what you call self-discovery in the Little Missouri. It really is a great story. Can you tell us that one?
Absolutely. Okay, so the Little Missouri is this river that gets very high in the spring. Okay, all the snow melts. Okay, so the Little Missouri is raging, and it's going over a dam that's submerged. Okay, so this dam is underwater. And everybody says to Roosevelt, look, don't try and cross that thing, okay? You know, you're going to get knocked off. Because there's still ice in the river. It's very cold and everything. Roosevelt says, nonsense, Manitou and I can do it. So he and the horse start to go across the river at this point, and as they're going across, of course, the horse loses his footing and goes off the dam. So now they're in the Little Missouri, which is a very swift river with monstrous pieces of ice all around them. I mean, forget the fact they could freeze to death. They could just get sucked under all this ice. Well, Roosevelt clings to the horse. The horse, as they go down, kind of makes his way across, gets to the far side, and they go up to the opposite side and, you know, steaming away from all the water and everything and in the cold. But again, Roosevelt survived.
And doesn't he say later, he says something about, he said maybe it wasn't so smart, but it sure was fun.
Yeah, and he does it again. So, I mean, and here's another thing. Here's another example of Roosevelt. Okay, so Roosevelt has these big, thick glasses. He's out by himself again. It's late. So he goes to a town called Mingusville. And Mingusville is just another of these Wild West towns that cowboys go into and shoot them up. All right. Roosevelt comes in. There's a guy in the saloon with his guns out, shooting away different things. Roosevelt goes and sits down. The guy turns and goes, Four Eyes is buying drinks for the house. And Roosevelt's used to this. He's constantly ribbed because of his glasses. So he's sitting there, and he's sitting there, and this big guy with these guns just stays on him, comes up over him, and he says, are you buying or not? And Roosevelt says, well, if I have to, I have to. He stands up, hooks him with a right, then a left, and knocks this guy out cold. This bad man with these guns. Well, you know, in the West, there's nothing greater than facing down a bad man. So Roosevelt's reputation immediately goes up. He's known as a man who can stand by his word. And he does have courage. Roosevelt has grit and courage, right? So he faces down this bad man in Mingusville. And this sort of adds to the legend of Roosevelt, already begun out west as a man who can back up what he said.
You know, William, I told you already that I love history, and I'm also a Christian, and so I'm always interested in the spiritual side of people. It isn't always written, and I don't even know if you talked about this, but I just want to mention I was interviewing a Churchill's niece one time in Washington D.C. For a national program I was doing. And I asked her off mic, because her book wasn't about this, I said, you know, Churchill was such a great man, and he often referred to things that are biblical principles, even if he didn't quote a chapter and verse, and sometimes he even did. And I said, no, I don't know anything about his religious views or where he stood. And she told me off mic that he had a nanny who was from the Free Church of England, who was a very conservative Christian, who raised him because his parents kind of neglected him. And so he was very close to her. And I thought, you know, that to me, from my perspective, I thought that it kind of explained his grit. So I thought the same thing about Roosevelt, and I was just looking, and it turns out that Roosevelt was also, I don't know how strong his personal faith was, but he certainly did write that a thorough knowledge of the Bible is worth more than a college education. And he also wrote, to educate a man in mind and not in morals is to educate a menace to society. His faith was very important to him. I think that formulates a man's character, so that's just interesting to me. But
yeah, well, I think you're right, and I think in the Christian virtues, he's emblematic of sort of a muscular Christianity of his time. Here's another great, great moment. But probably it sort of backs up what we were just talking about. Roosevelt has a boat on the Little Missouri, and so they want to go hunting. Well, the boat gets stolen. Roosevelt's furious and demands that they go after the people who stole it. They know who it is. It's three sort of outlaw types, all right? So Roosevelt and his hired men build a boat, go down the Little Missouri in the dead of winter, okay, in the Badlands. It's freezing out. It's snowing. They're in this open boat. Roosevelt brings along Anna Karenina, Tolstoy, to read as he's going down. He always had a book going, okay? So they float down. They find these three guys, take them, you know, with guns drawn. Right? Now, Roosevelt is a sheriff now. He's playing the role of sheriff. He has to bring these men back to justice. So then they have to keep these guys alive, and Roosevelt has to keep his gun on them at all times. He can't sleep. So over the next 4 days, they float down this river further. It's just brutal. It's just, you know, the dead of winter, they're freezing. And then they have to get out of this and walk all the way to this outlying ranch with these guys. And Roosevelt, you know, everybody's like, you know what, just forget about these guys. Get rid of them. Roosevelt, no, I'm bringing them to justice. So Sheriff Roosevelt does. He has to walk behind a wagon with them. He has to sit up all night while they're sleeping, and he's not. He finally gives them to the Justice of Peace, who gives them $35 for bringing them in. And so, again, this is Roosevelt, the sort of this moral code, you know, in the Wild West, saying, no, right is right, wrong is wrong. He's saying, well, what's with the boat? You know, so they stole a boat. But in Roosevelt's mind, they had broke the law. And he, as Sheriff Roosevelt, as he appointed himself, was going to bring them in. So again, another sort of Roosevelt fantasy of being the Wild West sheriff, high noon, bringing in the bad guys. And I think this probably backs up into what you're talking about, his sort of muscular Christianity. You know, yeah. There's a right and a wrong, clearly.
Yeah. William, we're almost out of time, but you mentioned this earlier, and this would be a great way to close. You talked about destiny, and I think based on what you said, that you believe there was sort of a destiny to Roosevelt. Of course, he did become the 26th president after all of these. These are just a few of his adventures. And
right.
You talk about a freight train ride he took with Arthur Picard, that is sort of kind of a prophecy of what was to come. Can you tell that story in closing?
Sure. They had gone back to the West after Roosevelt had been governor, and he came back to visit the West. And he said to him, he said, you know, I know every little piece of this area out here. And he said, this is where the romance of my life began. You know, and he said also, I could never become, and I think he was talking about being president, I could never become who I am without the West. And Arthur Picard said then, he said, well, then you will one day be president. And Roosevelt said, and this happened a lot. Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up, because he would be out on the be on a roundup, and somebody would say to him, they'd say, you know, one day you're going to go back, you're going to get tired of being with cattle and out west, and you're going to recover from the death of your wife and the death of your mother, and you're going to go back, and then you're going to become president. And Roosevelt would just take this in stride and sort of say, maybe, you know, I don't know about that. But it's amazing how many people saw that in him so early.
Yeah, it is. It is, you know, from your book, this is what you write that he said in regard. He said, if your prophecy comes true, I will do my part to make a good one. And certainly he did. In fact, in closing, William, how would you describe his presidency?
I would say his presidency was one of the bench-setting presidencies where he would do the right thing regardless of the cost, regardless of party, regardless of the pressure. It's how he took on J.P. Morgan. It's how he left us the legacy of the West and land conservation. Roosevelt was truly a man who saw the right thing, period, and he would sacrifice everything to get it. It's something that's very foreign to us now because, you know, so much of politics is bought. But in Roosevelt's world, he didn't care who it was. He would take on somebody like J.P. Morgan. He would take on the big trust. He would take on whoever. Right was right. And again, this goes back to Sheriff Roosevelt. He came back from the West. The West created this man. He was our first cowboy president. And so that moral code of the West, you know, he carried with him.
Oh, it's a great book and a great topic. Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt. My guest has been William Hazelgrove. This is published by Regnery. And you're going to want to get this book, I think. And I hope you've enjoyed today's show. We'll do more of this in the days to come as we learn from our past and learn from the great men who forged this country in so many ways. This is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.